The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated May 9/May 16, 2022. The cover is bordered in red with a small, narrow inner border of white. Time, in large capital block letters, is in bright red, superimposed upon a black background. The portrait that is then superimposed upon that black background is the profile of Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. His hair is sharply cropped. It's dark. Now, this is mostly a black and white photo, as nearly as I can tell. He does have neatly trimmed facial hair. His eyes are dark, and the one that we see in the profile portrait is focused straight ahead. He's neither smiling nor frowning, but looking very strict. Beginning with one of the interior articles, it under health, it's the new science of forgetting. Can't recall the name of your third grade teacher? Don't worry, it is just your brain clearing the debris, by Corinne Pertil. Baby zebrafish is just half the size of a pea. A recent look inside its transparent brain, however, offers clues to the far bigger mystery of how we remember and how we forget. In an experiment that yielded insights into memory and the brain, a team of researchers at the University of Southern California taught the tiny creature to associate a bright light with a flash of heat, a temperature change the fish responded to by trying to swim away. Using a custom-designed microscope, the team then captured images of the animal's brains in the moments before and after they learned to associate the light and the heat. It is the first known look at how a living vertebrate's brain restructures itself as the animal forms a memory. In the image published with the team's research, the event looked like a dissipating firework. A frenetic spattering of bright yellow dots represents new connections created between brain cells at the moment the memory formed. But the image also shows a second parallel force at work in the animal's brain as those connections are made. An overlapping sprinkle of bright blue dots indicates synaptic connections that disappeared at the same time new ones were formed, as if the components of earlier zebrafish memories were making way for the new arrival. This glimpse into the mind of a zebrafish illuminates one of the most intriguing new fronts in science's quest to understand the brain, the biology of forgetting. We often experience forgetting as a frustration, the misplaced wallet, the name just on the tip of your tongue. And until fairly recently, the widely held convention in neuroscience was that forgetting was merely a glitch in the memory system. The brain's job was to gather and store information, and the inability to retain or retrieve those memories was a failure of some neurological or psychological mechanism. Over the past decade or so, however, science has determined that forgetting is not just the failure of memory, but its own distinct force. We were all taught forever, everyone, that forgetting is a passive breakdown of the memory mechanisms, said Scott A. Small, a professor of neurology and psychiatry at Columbia University and author of the 2021 book, Forgetting, The Benefits of Not Remembering. The fundamental insight, the eureka, I think, of the new science of forgetting is that our neurons are endowed with a completely separate set of mechanisms that are dedicated to active forgetting. The brain forms memory with the help of a complex toolkit of neurotransmitters, proteins, and carbohydrates, as well as other cells. Small writes, that's W-R-I-T-E-S. Forgetting, too, has its own set of dedicated molecular tools working to clear away what is no longer relevant. The mere existence of these neurobiological tools does not prove they're useful. Nature also gave us the appendix, and we're still trying to figure out what the point of that one is. But a constellation of findings in recent years, Small says, indicates that culling the vast amount of information the brain collects and encodes is a necessary function of cognition, as essential for survival as the gathering of useful knowledge. And now that we know this culling function exists, some researchers are exploring the possibility that disruptions to forgetting could provide insights into complex psychological conditions like post-traumatic stress disorder. After all, forgetting, says Oliver Hart, an assistant professor of psychology at McGill University, is one of the most fundamental aspects of a memory system. Without forgetting, nothing would work. The Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist Eric Kandel, K-A-N-D-E-L, a professor of biochemistry and biophysics at Columbia University, established in the 1970s that changes in the chemical signals between neurons were the biological basis of all learning or memory making. When neighboring brain cells or neurons are excited at the same time, neurotransmitter chemicals fire across the microscopic gap between the ends of the neuron's spindly dendrites. This change in the synapse, the connection point between neurons, is what makes a memory. For transient, short-term memories, that change is fleeting. The more a memory is revisited and repeated, however, the stronger and more enduring that change becomes. That is true of all animals capable of learning, Kandel found, from humans to the humble zebrafish. Practice makes perfect, Kandel said in his Nobel lecture, even in snails. If all animal brains are capable of forming new synaptic connections, it stands to reason they're also equipped to pare those connections away. That's P-A-R-E, the connections away. That picture of the zebrafish brain illustrates the simultaneous creation of new synaptic connections between some neurons and receding connections between others. From an evolutionary perspective, the purpose of memory is not to allow us to sit back and say, "Oh, do you remember that time?" says Sheena Joselyn, a senior scientist at the Hospital for Sick Children and a professor of psychology and physiology at the University of Toronto. It really is to help us make decisions. Without forgetting, the evolutionary benefits of a strong memory would become redundant, says Hart. In the course of a single day, the brain registers hundreds of thousands of bits of information, some of it relevant, and much of it utterly inconsequential. The way your socks felt when you pulled them onto your feet, the shirt color of a stranger standing before you in the grocery store line. you would have an endless amount of useless stuff accumulating there constantly, Hart says. And each time you want to think about something, something key to your survival, such as the location of food or the signs of an approaching predator, all these memories would pop up that are completely meaningless and that make it hard for you to actually do the job of predicting what is next. Hart is among the many scientists who suspect this culling of non-essential memory is one of the key purposes of sleep. A good night's sleep, quite literally, produces a clearer mind. Jocelyn and her spouse, Paul Frankland, run the Jocelyn Frankland Neurobiology Lab at Toronto's Hospital for Sick Children. Franklin's research at the hospital has focused on the kind of forgetting that takes place in the hippocampus when new learning takes place, the corresponding gain and loss of neuronal connections that the zebrafish brain showed. Franklin's breakthrough in forgetting came while he was studying neurogenesis, or the formation of new brain cells in mice. A graduate student noticed that the more quickly new neurons formed in the animal's hippocampus, the less likely the animal was to recall some older memories. Mice with more brain cells learned new mazes faster, but they were also more likely to forget the layouts of previous mazes they had mastered before their brain growth. Franklin has theorized that is why it's so difficult for people to remember events from early infancy, a time of exponential neural development. In this model, forgetting in the hippocampus is not a zero-sum, one-for-one replacement of knowledge, so much as an ongoing reconfiguring of memory so that more recent and likely more useful information is available more readily. The world changes, Franklin says, and so the more recent things are more relevant to remember, to predict the future, than the more distant things. Just as the brain cells and circuits distinguish between long and short-term memory, there also appears to be a distinction between memories that have decayed beyond the possibility of retrieval and what researchers call transient forgetting, the temporary, if deeply irritating, inability to recall a piece of learned information. Studies in fruit flies, most notably in the Scripps Research Institute Lab of Neuroscience, Professor Donald L. Davis, have identified dopamine as a key factor in the animal's ability to learn and forget. Last year, the lab found a dopamine-releasing circuit in the flies' brains linked to transient forgetting. Flies that had been taught to associate a particular odor with a shock to their feet seemed to forget what they had learned when distracted by stimuli like blue light or a puff of air. This temporary loss of memory was accompanied by the release of dopamine from a particular set of cells onto the cells thought to hold memory. If fruit flies have a mechanism that temporarily suppresses some memories, it stands to reason humans do too. Forgetting may be the basal state of the brain. We are inundated with so much information on a daily basis that the brain fights back and says, I can't handle this. I need to forget as much of the unimportant information as possible, Davis said. The brain is designed to slowly erase information that's coming in on a daily basis unless consolidation says, okay, this memory's important, and so it overrides the forgetting mechanism. As the neuroscience of forgetting emerges, some researchers are questioning whether the mechanisms that regulate forgetting might also hold valuable clues to other mysteries of cognitive and behavioral health. In his book, Small points to a few key areas in which the neuroscience of forgetting might point the way to other breakthroughs One area of interest is autism. In one 2016 study, when a protein associated with forgetting was inhibited in fruit flies, those that had been modified to contain genes linked to autism demonstrated behavioral inflexibility or difficulty adopting new patterns of behavior. The aversion to excess stimuli that some people with autism spectrum disorder show, Small says, could be the result of a brain unable to let go of unessential inputs. Post-traumatic stress disorder, likewise, could be the result of an injury to the forgetting function. One theory is that PTSD develops as a result of an overgrowth of synaptic connections in the amygdala, the part of the brain that acquires and stores fear memories after intense or repeated exposure to a frightening stimulus. Early studies show drugs that accelerate the loss of fear memories, most notably MDMA, could be effective in treating the symptoms of people with PTSD. The memory loss associated with Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia ranges far beyond the kind of routine forgetting that takes place in a healthy brain. Yet understanding the minute physical processes behind the undoing of memory could help researchers understand more about this painful symptom of the disease and maybe even find ways to slow or stop it. Perhaps we need to understand the forgetting process, how that works, why it's there, in order to find a better way to address it if it goes out of control, Hart says. Several researchers interviewed for this piece reference the Jorge Luis Borges short story, Funes the Memorius, to illustrate forgetting's role in how we navigate the world. An injury sustained in a riding accident leaves the title character with a chronic inability to forget anything at all. Funes learns multiple languages with ease and can cite millennial-long strings of historical facts, the kinds of things we think we do with infinite capacity for recall. But he is miserable. Funes cannot let go of anything. He looks at a landscape and registers every leaf on the vines, every hair in a pony's mane. He is swamped by minute changes of age and expression each time he looks at another person's face. Memories do not comfort him, they only overwhelm him. "My memory, sir, is like a garbage heap," Funes tells the narrator. Forgetting serves us well. It tunes out useless information so we can focus on the relevant. Without it, neither anger at a slight nor the pain of grief would fade. Feelings of love and attraction would not either, making it impossible to move on from relationships. Memories build us, and forgetting chisels away the excess, shaping the way we see ourselves and our world. This is the page with 8 questions. Someone from Time, in this case Charlie Campbell, asks questions of a guest. And in this page, it's Tina Brown, the journalist, on her new book about the British royal family, Prince Andrew's Sleaze, and what Diana would have been like as queen. Question: what was the biggest surprise in writing your new book, The Palace Papers? Answer: how incredibly difficult it is to fit in that system. You know it is a gilded cage. You know that there's all these constrictions. But by the end of it, I just felt like I'd been trapped in a mothballed cupboard with people banging on the door trying to get out. Question: you note that even at her most bitter ebb with the royal family, Diana was always a monarchist. How would she have performed as queen? Answer: the irony was that at the very end of her life in the 90s, she and Charles became on quite cordial terms. Today, in her 60s, she would have been in her prime. I believe she would have been an absolutely superb queen. Question: You note that Love and Strategy would be a good name for a Kate Middleton perfume. How big a role did Kate's mother have in arranging her union with William? Answer, no, it was a complete love match and still is. I think that Kate fell madly in love with William. But there is a difference between falling madly in love with somebody and being able to navigate for 10 years the obstacle course that was like a snakes and ladders game. I think that Kate's mother was hugely helpful in keeping that course steady. Question. You call Prince Andrew a coroneted sleaze machine and paint him as arrogant, entitled, and vindictive. Does he have any redeeming qualities? Answer. In some ways, I feel sorry for him. He is clearly a dim bulb. There's very little going on upstairs, and he's something of an oaf. Unfortunately, being intellectually dim and surrounded by sycophancy is a very bad combination. Question. I suppose the British people are lucky he wasn't the firstborn son? Answer. So lucky. Whatever misgivings you have about Prince Charles, he is an extremely decent man who strives to do good in the way that he sees it. Imagine if Andrew was about to be king. I think it would be the death of the institution. Question. Your portrayal of Prince Harry has him utterly consumed by hatred of the press. Doesn't that make his current foray into media all the more puzzling? Answer. I'm told that is the most puzzling to the royal family themselves at the moment. Apparently, what they say about Harry is, we don't recognize him. He's now writing a book that invades not just his own privacy, but also that of his family, when he's always suffered so deeply from these tell-all books. Question. After Meghan and Harry's hugely successful first tour to Australia in 2018, you write that Meghan believed that the monarchy likely needed her more than she needed them. Was she correct? Answer. A lot of her instincts were right, as we saw from the recent Commonwealth tour by William and Kate that went so badly. Meghan sensed that a lot of the stuff she was doing in Australia felt archaic. I think she had a lot to offer in terms of media modernity. But her pushback was just chaotically executed and done with such recklessness. Question. You suggest that if William and Kate's marriage got into trouble, the whole Windsor House of Cards could come tumbling down. Answer. It is in a fragile state, but I think that William has quite a lot of resemblance to his grandmother. He is very prudent. He is thoughtful. He is not headstrong. That is a lucky thing for the monarchy. You have to wonder if the first son had been Harry, would it have survived? Again, Times person asking the questions, Charlie Campbell, and Tina Brown is the respondent. There's a photo here of her. She's smiling. She's blonde. She has neatly coiffed hair. This is a black and white photo, so they're somewhat light, but I don't know what color. She looks like a totally pleasant person to speak with. From the movies review page, there are two reviews here, both written by Stephanie Zakarik. The Boxer Undone by His Sins. Now that so many books, movies, and TV shows fixate on emotional suffering, many of us are asking, how much is too much? The Survivor, directed by Barry Levinson, tells the real-life story of Harry Haft, H-A-F-T, played here by Ben Foster, a scrappy, light heavyweight boxer of the late 1940s who did well enough for himself. Rocky Marciano was one of his opponents. But Haft's story comes with an anguishing twist. A Polish Jew, he had survived the concentration camps by fighting other prisoners to the death for the entertainment of their SS overseers. After escaping the camps, Haft tried to build a new life for himself in the U.S., only to be dogged by guilt and, in the movie's telling, haunted by a lost love. At its core, The Survivor is a story of deep moral complexity, and Levinson is not quite subtle enough to tease out the nuances. He shifts dutifully between Haft's boxing career and the horrific deeds he is striving to forget, using some harrowing and effective flashbacks. But in places, Levinson belabors Haft's struggles. A few potent, understated sequences would be more telling than endless shots of Foster furrowing his brow with pained, feverish intensity. Even so, The Survivor's overall clumsiness cannot fully dim the power of its central idea. This is the story of choices no human being should ever be forced to make, and its final note of forgiveness feels like a salve. Second movie review, also by Stephanie Zakarik. A grim but timely warning from 1960s France. In Audrey Diwan's tense and quietly radical film, Happening, Anne, a bright young student in the early 1960s France, discovers she is pregnant. The law, as the doctor who breaks the news tells her, is unsparing. Anyone who helps her terminate the pregnancy will land in jail, as will she. Her closest friends abandon her when she confesses her plight. The father of the unborn child absolves himself of responsibility. A doctor who feigns sympathy pretends to help her, though in reality he's trying to seal her fate. And when she begs a male teacher to help her catch up on the lectures she's missed, he asks bluntly what has caused her absence. "The illness that strikes only women," she says, and turns them into housewives. The director of this film, Audrey Diwan's last name is spelled D-I-W-A-N. Happening, which won the top prize, the Golden Lion, at last year's Venice Film Festival, is a difficult film to watch. That's in part because of an agonizing, if discreetly shot, scene in which the heroine, played with raw, bruised resolution by Anna Maria Bartolome, attempts a DIY abortion with a knitting needle. When I saw the film in Venice, several audience members left the theater during this scene, though among those filing out, I counted not a single woman. But Diwan's film is less harrowing for its depictions of physical suffering than for its forthright exploration of Anne's emotional desolation. She is a country girl whose dream is to become a professor. But women who have sex before marriage are written off as fast. Their sexual desire is treated as a flaw, a cause for shame. Happening is adapted from the 2000 book by the French writer Annie Ernaux, entailing the experience of her own abortion in 1963. It is an unyielding picture in some ways. You might long for a sliver of optimism tucked amid its layers of grim truth, but then all its hope lies in Anne's face, as uncompromising as an early crocus. This is the face of a woman who deserves much more respect for her body, for her very life, than her society affords her. And if 1960s France seems like a faraway time and place, Happening comes entwined with a warning. The country it's showing us could very likely be the United States of tomorrow. From the brief news, space. White House bans U.S. tests of space weapons. Seeking to slow the emerging space arms race among world powers, the Biden administration, April 18, announced a unilateral moratorium on anti-satellite missile tests, calling on other spacefaring nations to follow suit. Vice President Kamala Harris announced the U.S. prohibition after high-profile tests in recent years by Russia, China, and India that obliterated orbiting satellites and created hazardous clouds of debris that will linger in outer space for decades. Simply put, these tests are dangerous, and we will not conduct them, she said during a speech from Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. We are the first nation to make such a commitment. The risk of human conflict extending into the cosmos is on the rise, as the world has become ever more reliant upon satellites to communicate, navigate, and conduct daily life. More nations, militaries, and companies have taken advantage of novel space technologies in recent years, resulting in more capabilities here on Earth, but more competition in the heavens among global powers. Anti-satellite, ASAT, weapons testing goes back to the earliest days of the Cold War. Over the past decade, however, the U.S., Russia, and China have developed sophisticated anti-satellite arsenals designed to render satellites deaf, mute, and blind in space. Missiles may be the only widely known space weapon, but several nations have developed other measures, including lasers, jamming capabilities, cyber attacks, and maneuverable spacecraft designed to deceive, disrupt, deny, degrade, or destroy other nations' space systems. Despite these advancements, there are few enforceable rules for military action in space. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty forbids countries from deploying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction in space. But that language is broad, space experts and arms control analysts say, and could not foresee the rapid pace of technology now in development. Reining in the proliferation of such weaponry is essential, they say, to avoiding international catastrophe, either intentional or accidental. Until recently, space was seen as a peaceful domain. Many satellites, like the GPS constellation, were thought to be too far away and too costly to target, but growing missile technology and arsenals have brought them in range. This new reality was a prime driver behind the creation of the Space Force as a new uniformed service of the U.S. military in 2019. And while the U.S.-Russia partnership in space traditionally transcended terrestrial political tensions, even during the Cold War, Russia's unprovoked invasion into Ukraine has raised tensions between the two countries' space programs. Dmitry Rogozin, head of Russia's space program, has threatened to pull out of the International Space Station and stop supplying rocket engines to U.S. companies. Todd Harrison, director of the Aerospace Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said Washington is giving up very little by banning ASAT tests because the weapons do more harm than good, but it puts the United States back in the position of leading by example. And that column was written by W.J. Hennigan. On the same page of brief news, economy. Why the rent won't stop rising. New York University graduate student Garrett DeGraffenried expected the rent on his Manhattan apartment to rise, but he did not anticipate by how much. Last year's lease averaged to $1,600 per month. February 11, he got a notice that a new lease would raise it to $2,750, a 69% surge. Double-digit rent spikes are hardly isolated to Manhattan. From 2021 to 2022, rents rose 26% in Henderson, Nevada, 39% in Miami, per Zumper, a rental platform. Nationwide, from March 2021 to March 2022, rent for a one-bedroom rose an average of 12%. For millions, these hikes are existential. If you can't afford your new lease, but you also can't afford to pony up for moving expenses, what happens? This is not a short-term pandemic-related problem, experts say, it is born of deep disconnect between supply and demand. The elephant in the room is a lack of new housing. Since 2008, new construction has moved at a snail's pace, and pandemic-related supply chain problems and labor shortages have made things worse. At the same time, demand has spiked as remote work policies pushed millions of renters to towns and small cities where would-be buyers were iced out of the housing market. Home prices rose 17% last year alone. To meet the current demand for affordable homes, builders would have to construct 4.6 million new apartments by 2030, according to the National Apartment Association. Congress, meanwhile, allocated nearly $47 billion from 2020 to 2021 to stave off evictions during the COVID-19 crisis. Some $22 billion remains unspent and could theoretically be used to help people facing displacement from rent spikes. But it is unclear exactly how. We actually have to fix this problem in the long run, says Ann Oliva of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Some other federal funds could help. In addition to the $47 billion in rental assistance, Congress allocated $350 billion to facilitate state and local fiscal recovery projects. Such projects can include offering hazard pay to essential workers or building new infrastructure. Oliva says governments could jump on that funding to help renters with price hikes in the short term and to help address the underlying mismatch between housing supply and demand down the road. Unfortunately, if there is a light at the end of the tunnel, it is too far away to see for de Graffenried and others in the same situation now. At the rate of current housing construction, people all over the country will likely see rents increase again next year. That article was written by Abby Vesoulis. Immigration. Lawsuit filed over tracking immigrants. More than 216,000 people with pending cases before U.S. immigration courts have been placed in a federal government tracking program, according to federal data released April 14. Since President Joe Biden took office, the number of immigrants in the Alternatives to Detention, ATD, program has more than doubled, reflecting the administration's embrace of new surveillance technology as a tool to limit reliance on government-funded detention centers. While immigrant advocates have long called on U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to reduce or end the use of immigrant detention centers, they say the ATD program raises a fresh set of concerns about immigrants' privacy and civil rights. April 14, three immigrant advocacy organizations, Just Futures Law, Mijente or Mijente, and Community Justice Exchange filed a lawsuit against ICE, calling on the agency to provide information showing what data is being collected on individuals enrolled in the ATD program, who are increasingly monitored through a phone app called SmartLink, which combines GPS with voice and facial recognition. As the number of immigrants monitored under ATD has ticked up, the number in ICE detention centers has declined. But it is not a direct one-to-one correlation, says Austin Coker, assistant professor and researcher at Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, a research organization at Syracuse University. The number of immigrants in ATD has expanded, while the number of people in immigrant detention facilities has fluctuated, he says. ATD is more of a mechanism for ICE to expand their ability to monitor immigrants who are in the country, Coker says. An ICE spokesperson would not comment on the new litigation, but said the agency's committed to protecting privacy rights and the civil rights and liberties of those in the ATD program. For the immigrant advocates who have filed suit against ICE, the bigger issue is how immigrants' data is being harvested and utilized. We are going to continue to be part of this lawsuit until we can get some basic information to understand how people's most personal data, their biometric information, are being used by private companies and the government in this moment, says Jacinta Gonzalez, Senior Campaign Director at Mahanti. Jasmine Aguilera wrote that article. More brief news. This is under the heading World, how Ukraine is crowdsourcing digital evidence of war crimes, by Vera Bergengruen. It all looks like a game at first. Verified users of Ukraine's government mobile app are greeted with icons of military helmets and targets. An automated prompt helps you report Russian troop movements in your area and rewards you with a flexed arm emoji. Remember, the message says, each of your shots in this bot means one less enemy. Another option on the menu, denoted by a droplet of blood, prompts Ukrainians to report and submit footage of war crimes in places now associated with atrocities, Bucha, Irpin, Gostomel. This chat box, created by Ukraine's digital ministry and dubbed E-Enemy, is one of a half dozen digital tools the government in Kyiv has set up to crowdsource and corroborate evidence of possible war crimes. Since the start of the invasion, Ukrainian officials, lawyers, and human rights groups have scrambled to design new ways to catalog and verify reams of video, photo, and eyewitness accounts of criminal behavior by Russian forces. Ukraine has adapted popular government apps to allow citizens to document damage to their homes, used facial recognition software to identify Russian military officials in photos, and rolled out new tools to guide users through the process of geotagging and timestamping their footage in hopes it may help authorities hold the perpetrators responsible. The result is a systematic effort unlike any in the history of modern warfare, experts say. Crowdsourcing digital proof of war crimes has been done in other conflicts, but the use of open source information as evidence in the case of Ukraine may be at altogether a different level, says Nadia Volkova, director of the Ukrainian Legal Advisory Group. The apps, chatbots, and websites designed by Ukrainian officials categorize different kinds of war crimes and human rights violations and feed them into one centralized database. These include the killing or injury of civilians by Russians, physical violence or imprisonment, denial of medical care, looting, and seizure of property by occupying forces. Ukrainians are rallying to the cause. A website set up by the Office of Ukraine's Prosecutor General has received more than 10,000 submissions of detailed evidence from citizens, an official told Time. The government's efforts are supported by a legion of outside human rights groups, citizen sleuths, cyber volunteers, and open source analysts. Now, there's a color photo accompanying this column. It's almost a fourth of a page in volume. It is in color. The background, which fills the frame, is that of rubble of a multi-story building. The windows are blown out. There's rebar hanging and being dragged about everywhere by slabs of concrete and boards. But in the center of the photo is a man with probably a cell phone or a small camera, and he's taking a photograph of this bizarre-looking rubble. He's dressed in blue jeans, a black or very dark gray jacket, and a likewise colored cap and That's all there is to the story. He's taking pictures of the mess. Referring to the text now, what all this will yield remains unclear. International war crimes cases are notoriously difficult to prosecute. Successful efforts are typically built on traditional forensic evidence, witness testimonies, and documents. But Ukrainian officials say the purpose of using digital tools to crowdsource evidence of Russian atrocities extends beyond a war crimes trial in The Hague. They see it as a defense against a flood of Russian disinformation, including claims from Kremlin officials that the horrors from Bucha or Mariupol are fake or staged. Mykhailo Fedorov, Ukraine's Minister of Digital Transformation, says the country's collection of citizen evidence is another way Ukraine is reinventing modern warfare. This war has been the most radical shift in warfare since World War II, at least in Europe, he tells Time. If you look at what happened in cyber war, we have changed the playbook basically overnight. I firmly believe that we will be able to change the way international justice is being administered as well in the aftermath of this war. Fedorov's ministry quickly realized their pre-war project to digitize the country's government services had now become an invaluable tool for documenting war crimes. In order to make a report through the e-enemy chatbot, users have to log in through a portal launched in 2020 that lets Ukrainians share digital identifying documents on their smartphones for more than 50 government services. Roughly 40% of Ukrainian citizens use the app, according to Fedorov. We use rigorous authentication in order to weed out fake content, Fedorov says. As a result, about 80 to 90% of the user-submitted content is usable. More than 253,000 people have sent reports and footage of Russian forces' movements and actions through the chatbot. More than 66,000 have submitted evidence of damage to their homes and cities. The dashboard on the government's war crimes portal lists almost 6,500 submissions of photos, videos, and other documentation. One graphic cataloging crimes against children counts at least 191 killed and another 349 wounded. Another section is labeled Enemy's Personal Data, allowing the user to provide any identifying information about Russian troops. As of April 14, the office said it has identified 570 suspects, including Russian military and political officials, ministers, and heads of law enforcement. Holding them accountable will be a complicated process. Trying war criminals is incredibly difficult because the burden of proof is so high, says Flynn Coleman, an international human rights lawyer. Still, the value of Ukraine's crowdsourced evidence goes beyond what can be proven in international court. It is a basic right for all the survivors and families, Coleman says. We need a record for humanity of what happened here. Not just justice, but a record, because memories fade. Question and answer. Activist Nadia Murad, M-U-R-A-D, on sexual violence as a weapon of war, by Angelina Jolie. In 2014, Nadia Murad's homeland of Kocho, Iraq, was captured by the Islamic State. Several members of her family were killed, and she, along with other women and girls from town, were abducted and held as sex slaves. After months in captivity, Murad escaped and found refuge in Germany. She has since dedicated herself to raising awareness about the use of rape and sexual violence against women and children as a weapon of war, and was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her efforts. She recently launched the Murad Code, which offers guidelines on how to sensitively collect evidence from survivors and witnesses during wartime. I spoke to her about recent reports of sexual violence being used against women and children during the Russian invasion of Ukraine. AJ, Angelina Jolie, there's evidence that this violence is done to intentionally destroy the human being, the family, the community. Could you help those who do not understand why it is a weapon? NM, Nadia Murad. Terrorist groups use rape as a way to destroy women because they know that this can stay with women. They know that the stigma and the shame in many communities follow a woman after sexual slavery and rape. For my family these days, when I see my sisters-in-law, after what they've been through, nothing is the same for us. When we talk, there's nothing for us to talk about as a normal family anymore. Question. With Ukraine, what do you hope governments are doing at this time that might help with accountability? Answer. When the international coalition was formed to defeat ISIS, they made the mistake of not considering specifically that violence against women was a main element of this war. Violence against women, and sexual violence in particular in conflict zones, is considered a side effect. World leaders need to understand that whether it's in Yemen or Ukraine or any other place, violence against women will occur, and we should make sure that we have that in mind when planning to deal with these conflicts. Question. There's been a lack of accountability for these crimes that has really emboldened people to behave this way and not consider it a crime of war? Answer. It is my belief as a survivor that we cannot separate accountability from prevention. If we do not hold those who have committed these crimes accountable, it will not prevent this from happening to other women. Question. I have so much admiration for women like you who have held together and continued to do this work in the absence of justice. Answer. Someone has to say what happened to us. I know it's the right thing to do because I know I will not be the last one to face this type of violence. I know it's going to take a long time, but I know it is the right thing to do. And the author, Jolie, is a Time-contributing editor and special envoy of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. From the View Inbox, Into the Metaverse by Andrew R. Chow, staff writer, Culture and Tech. If you are watching the Coachella YouTube live stream on either of the festival's Saturday nights in April, you might have done a double take as giant leafy trees and a Godzilla-sized parrot slowly rose above the stage of the electronic artist Flume. Were they giant inflatables? Mirages on a 200-foot-tall LED screen? Sheer hallucinations of the mind? None of the above. This year, Coachella partnered with Unreal Engine, Epic Games' 3D software development tool, to create what organizers say is the first live stream to add augmented reality, AR, tech into a music festival performance. Unreal Engine worked with Flume's artistic team and other technical collaborators to create massive psychedelic 3D images that blended in seamlessly with his stage design, floating around the artist and into the Indio, California sky. But nobody at the festival could see those enormous parrots, only viewers at home. The result, although it lasted only a few minutes, serves as a template for how live event planners might wield metaverse technology going forward to create unique experiences for at-home viewers. Many metaverse builders believe live events will be increasingly hybrid, with both digital and real-world components, and that immersive tools might help make each version of the event distinctive and desirable in its own right. It does not make sense to just recreate the live music experience virtually, says Sam Schoonover, the innovation lead for Coachella. Instead, you should give fans something new and different that they cannot do in real life. The giant parrots, which were designed by the artist Jonathan Zawada, are only the beginning of what might be created in AR for live concerts. Future performers could have lightning effects surrounding their faces at all times, or sync their dance moves to those of surrounding avatars. Schoonover says these AR experiences will jump another level when AR glasses are more common. Eventually, you might be able to see the concert in 3D, as if from the festival grounds, surrounded by floating birds, plants, and whatever else artists dream up, all while still sitting on your couch. Time Off recommends television, Selling Sunset, the inexplicably addictive docu-soap following glammed-up real estate agents selling Los Angeles mansions, returns for a season that promises to deliver behind-the-scenes details about the tabloid newsmaking romance between agent Chrishell Staus and broker Jason Oppenheim. Movies, Paris, 13th District. Longing and Heartbreak take center stage in Jacques Audiard's Paris, 13th District, the adaptation of Adrian Tomine's graphic novel Killing and Dying. Following four sometime lovers, sometime friends, the black and white film is an ode to the city of love. Books, What We Do in the Dark. When Michelle Hart's Mallory is in college, she begins an affair with an older married woman, fueled perhaps by the loneliness that follows her mother's death. Years later, she must decide whether to confront the woman. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.